You're listening to Interviews with Adam. I am your host, Adam Miller, and today we're going to be talking about politics, which we don't often talk about politics on the broadcast, but as a Christian in the world in which we're living, we're starting to see more and more that Christianity is being pushed out of the mainstream, and we are living in what many have called a post-Christian nation, and we certainly understand that here in New England and the Northeast. And our guest today is Rod Dreher, who is the author of a new book called The Benedict Option. It's a strategy for Christians in a post-Christian nation. It's a great privilege to have him on the broadcast with us. Rod, thank you so much for being a part of the many voices for that one message.
Hey, Adam. Thank you so much for having me on.
Why don't you get us started by telling us a little bit about the title of this book? This is really the summation of your book, so you're going to have to give us a brief summary of what you do in several hundred pages, but what is the Benedict Option?
Oh, wow. That's a difficult question, but it's an important one because a lot of people see the title and they don't know what it means, and so that's the first question they have. It's as simple as this. Saint Benedict of Nursia was a devoted Christian who went down to the city of Rome not long after it fell to the barbarians. He had to complete his education. He got there and found nothing but chaos and decadence. And as a Christian, he said, "I can't have any part of this." So he went out to the woods to pray and to seek the Lord's will. What he ended up doing was feeling the calling to start a religious order. So, and he founded 13 monasteries before he died in the year 547. And he wrote what is now known as the Rule of Saint Benedict, which is simply a guide for how to run a monastery. What Saint Benedict accomplished, and we didn't really understand this till two or three centuries later, was he basically laid the groundwork for the rebirth of civilization in the West by starting these monasteries, which moved out. Young men came into the monastic movement. They moved all throughout Western Europe, which had not been evangelized then, and led people to Christ, taught them how to pray, taught them how to worship, taught them all kinds of things, the arts of civilization. And within those monasteries, they kept alive the cultural memory of Christianity and the greatness of Greco-Roman civilization. So when things began to settle down in the West and the barbarians began to get civilized, the monks were there to help Christianize society even more. What I say today in my book, The Benedict Option, is that we are living in a time that has many things in common with the fall of the Roman Empire. And it's not just me saying this. Pope Benedict XVI said that the spiritual crisis in the West is the worst that it's been since the fall of Rome. And a philosopher, a very famous contemporary philosopher named Alistair MacIntyre, he said the same thing. He said that we don't have the technological collapse and economic collapse that Rome did, but we are living amid a moral collapse where we have lost the center of our civilization. I would say we've lost it because we've lost Christianity. So what the Benedict Option is the choice, I think, facing all serious Christians today. We can either continue to go along, to get along, and just kind of hope that things work out for us, that things come back, or we can look around and take honest stock of the crisis facing us and return to a much more rigorous practice of our faith, not only in terms of studying our scripture more and familiarizing ourselves more with church history, but also in our practices, in praying more devoutly, in thickening our ties to each other within the church and within Christian schools and communities, and basically building a metaphorical ark for ourselves to ride across this time, this new dark age that's upon us. We don't know how long it's going to last. This is not, I should say, a hiding away from the rest of the world, a heading for the hills. Rather, this is for Christians like me who live in the world, but who need help, need each other, and need our churches to be stronger so we can go out into the world and represent Christ authentically in a post-Christian age.
You know, essentially, you know, what you're saying is what we have to do is reassure our base and get the foundation of our Christian faith restored in our own camp as opposed to spreading ourselves. Do you think we spread ourselves so thin when it comes to trying to affect the world in so many different areas that we haven't really laid our own foundation well enough to be able to stand in these troubling days?
Oh, absolutely, Adam. I quote in my book this well-known historian of the early church, Robert Louis Wilkin. He's a contemporary scholar. And he was talking about the crisis of the faith in the West. And he says that nothing is more important for the church now than to tell itself its own story, because we've forgotten it. You can look at statistics done. I'm particularly interested in these studies done by sociologist Christian Smith of the University of Notre Dame. He has studied extensively American young people, and he has found that knowledge of even the basics of the Christian faith is next to non-existent. Instead, Christianity for so many Americans, and I would say not just young people, but people of my generation, I'm 50 years old. For us, Christianity has become little more than a psychological comfort. Jesus is our best friend. God wants us to be happy, and that's pretty much where it ends. This is not a faith, Adam, that is going to survive any kind of persecution or any kind of testing at all. We have to keep evangelizing the world. There's no question about that. The Great Commission is a mandate for us, but we cannot give people what we don't have ourselves. And if we want to be able to evangelize in the future, we have got to shore up our base in a tremendous way, because it has become very, very weak and very thin.
Mm. You talk about it in the subtitle of your book that this is a post-Christian nation, and this is a term we've heard a lot and from many different sources. But this is also a real struggle for a lot of people who see America as a Christian nation with Christian leanings, or at least a Judeo-Christian ethic as its foundation. And their struggle is with that change, and they're not willing to maybe even see it for what it actually is. What advice do you have for people to see what world we're actually living in now, and how do you even, for that person who wants to see this as a Christian nation because of its foundation, how do you address them to show them that it's no longer, even if it once was, it's no longer leaning in that direction?
Yeah, it's a pretty scary thing for most people. And believe me, it's a pretty hard thing for me to take too, but I feel that you just have to look at the statistics, at how many young people are falling away from the faith. We have never seen so many young adults falling away from the faith in American history as we're doing right now. Last year, couple of well-known religion sociologists of religion published an analysis showing that for the longest time, the United States was seen as a counterexample to European secularism. Europe has been losing its Christian faith for most of the 20th century in a dramatic way. But the United States has held on more or less to Christian observance. Now, though, we are on exactly the same track as Europe, the secularization. And what I would tell my fellow believers who simply don't want to see it, who think that we actually have a moral majority in this country of people who are seriously Christian, but we just need to get rid of the liberals who are ruling us and Hollywood, and we'll be able to bring forth the real faith of the American people. You're living in yesterday. That is not where this country is. And I hope that the country can and will in the future return to its Christian roots. Well, we're going to have to go through a long period of sort of Babylonian exile, we believers who live in America, and hold on to the faith until such time as the country is ready to hear the gospel again. I think that so many of us have assumed, or have maybe even unconsciously conflated the faith with American patriotism, and it just isn't so anymore, if it ever was. Again, this is not a reason to panic, but it is a reason to try to see things more clearly and realize that we are in very different times. Post-Christian America does not mean there are no Christians anywhere. Clearly there are, but the things are changing so quickly, Adam, that a lot of people alive today are going to live through the closing of many, many churches as younger people just fade away.
Now, you wrote this book when all of the prognosticators were anticipating a completely different direction for our federal government. So many of our listeners may be thinking, oh yeah, well that was well and good then when things seemed so much more bleak. But now we've had, you know, a lot of Christian conservatives will say we've got Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. A lot of them will be seeing that we're moving in the right direction as opposed to what you and many others are still saying that we're living in a post-Christian culture. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say that you're whistling past the graveyard if you think that. I was just as surprised as most people that Donald Trump won. I breathed a sigh of relief for religious liberty because we saw in the two terms of the Obama administration a real assault growing on religious liberty in this country, and it would have continued and gotten even worse under President Hillary Clinton. I don't think that's going to happen under President Donald Trump, and I'm thrilled that Neil Gorsuch is now in the Supreme Court. But we have to keep in mind that these trends that have been taking America further and further downstream from its Christian foundation have been going on for a very long time. And if Donald Trump were a saint, he couldn't stop all these things. Donald Trump is very far from a saint. I had hoped when he was inaugurated that he would issue these executive orders that a lot of Christian conservatives thought he would do guarding religious liberty. They haven't been issued yet. And my great fear for Trump is that he listens too much to Jared Kushner and his daughter Ivanka, who are very much social liberals. And that grieves me to think about it. But I believe that we have to be hopeful that and keep pushing Trump to take measures to protect religious liberty. But he may lose. He's not going to be in the White House forever. Even if he does all the right things from our point of view, he's not going to be there forever. And unfortunately, Christian voters, Christian conservative voters, are concentrated in the older demographics. And things are going to change a lot within my lifetime. And we Christians have got to be hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst.
And I think also with this election, a kind of side swipe here is that there's been a huge backlash against Christians for supporting Trump, and it's almost as though the attacks or the hatred towards Christianity in America has kind of increased as a result.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And if the wheels come off the Trump administration, the first ones that the liberals are going to turn on are going to be Christians. And I don't believe that the Republicans are going to stand up for us at all. And I say that as somebody who was a conservative and who usually votes Republican. And I'll tell you what turned me around on this issue. I write in the book that the Obergefell ruling, legalizing or constitutionalizing same-sex marriage, was a real turning point. But even before that, a couple of months before that, we had the Religious Freedom Restoration Act debacle in the state of Indiana. The state tried to pass a state version of the federal RFRA, as we call it, and received an enormous amount of pushback from big business. This was the first time that big business had ever involved itself in a culture war issue, and it came down like a ton of bricks on Republicans and Christians. And the state of Indiana, as your listeners will recall, backed down from that. A week later, the state of Arkansas, the governor vetoed a similar bill after Walmart cleared its throat. What this taught me, and it ought to be a signal lesson for all conservative Christians, is when it comes right down to it, the Republican Party will not have our back because it's more afraid of big business and business lobbyists than it is of Christian conservatives. I've talked to friends of mine who are Christians involved in lobbying at the state and national level on religious liberty issues, and they say the same thing. Big business is putting the squeeze on Republican politicians, but these same Republicans are not hearing from their Christian conservative constituents.
Now we're talking about politics, and politics and religion hardly ever mix. And we can actually see that in the sense where a lot of evangelicals don't agree on a national politic of how to best approach a lot of these issues. While there are larger percentages that are conservative and there are those that vote in a large block for the Republican Party, there's still pretty diverse feelings amongst evangelicals. So how do you address this question to a populace that is actually pretty bothered by our national politics on both sides. How does the Benedict option address both of their concerns?
Well, thank you for asking that, because I would count myself, even though I'm a conservative, I'm a registered independent. I live in a red state, Louisiana, and I don't see much to be hopeful about in either party, frankly. What I talk about in the Benedict option is something called anti-political politics. And this is a concept that was pioneered by dissidents from Czech communism. Václav Havel, many of your listeners will remember, was the first president of a free Czechoslovakia. He was, under the communists, the leading dissident and went to prison for his beliefs. He said that in a time when people of good character feel that they can't have any impact, any meaningful impact on national politics, as was certainly the case under the communist dictatorship, that doesn't free us from having to live the responsibility to live in truth and live upstanding, morally responsible lives. What Havel suggested, and one of his Christian colleagues, a guy named Václav Benda, a mathematician, suggested, was thinking of politics in terms of the radically local. You know, you may not be able to affect government, the elections or the legislatures that much, but politics is about how we live in common. What you can do is get involved in your local church, get involved in local organizations, not necessarily only Christian ones, but do change things at the local level. You can control that much. I think that this is going to be the way of the politics of the future for all of us, because as things in Washington grind ever more to a standstill, that doesn't free us or liberate us from having to care about the common good. What it does, though, is it frees us up to be more creative about what politics means to us. In my own life, my wife is involved in helping build up a classical Christian school here in Baton Rouge, where we live. And she's an Eastern Orthodox Christian. We're Orthodox Christians, but they're Catholics and they're mostly evangelicals involved in this school. We're coming together for the common good to build a classical Christian school that can serve everybody. And to me, that's kind of politics that I can believe in.
You know, you're talking about something that's kind of grassroots politics, right? And this has always been a very key element to the conservative party, that we want limited government and we want a grassroots movement where people are taking ownership and more local. But within that idea, there's always a huge emphasis on the top-down model. Even from the conservative parties, there's always an emphasis that we need to make sure that we get the top offices and fill those first. Do you see what I'm saying? That there's always been an emphasis and a consensus that we believe, you know, as I'm a conservative myself, but we think that we have to do things on a personal level, and yet we always put way more emphasis on the federal level.
Yeah, you know, this is one thing that really frustrates me as a Christian and as a conservative. There is no policy fix for the breakdown of the family. Policy can fiddle around the margins, but in the end, this is a cultural problem, this is a spiritual problem, this is a moral problem that can only be effectively addressed by the churches and at the grassroots level. Similarly with education, and I've talked to so many teachers, both in public and private schools, who say the real challenge to educating kids are the parents who don't seem to care, who think that they can just, you know, outsource the raising of their children and the moral formation of their children to the schools. You know, until and unless we get the families and communities of families built back up, nothing we do at the policy level is going to amount to much of anything. But that's, you can't raise money on that, Adam. You can't go out and get donors to give money for, you know, building up local schools or reading programs or this or that program for youth in the church. And I think that Christians we're going to have to take realistic stock of what can be accomplished and what cannot be accomplished through conventional politics and redirect our giving and our hopes and our efforts to the local.
Yeah. You know, this is something I'll have in a lot of private conversations with people who are, I mean, when we watch the mainstream media, when we're listening to our politicians, it's extremely stress-inducing and anxiety-ridden. And I always just tell them, you know, turn off the news, look around you at what impact you can have. You know, we know far more about the North Dakota pipeline than we do about our own access to energy. We know far more about Flint, Michigan's water crisis than where we're getting our water in our own town. Like, there is this mindset that we know far more about what's happening outside of our world of influence than what we do, what's happening in our own neighborhoods. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm just as guilty about that as anybody, because the job I do as a senior editor for the American Conservative means that I'm online most of the day. And I am often more aware of what's going on in the suburbs of Paris than I am in the suburbs of Baton Rouge. There's something really wrong with that. And it's something I need to fight against. But I'll tell you, one interesting thing I found out in my research for the Benedict Option is this this Christian dissident from the communists, Václav Benda. He believed that the communist government in Czechoslovakia maintained its power by atomizing people, by keeping people from coming together and trusting each other and building those natural bonds of community. And they did that because you never knew who was going to be spying on you and who among your neighbors was going to turn you into the police. But Benda said the only way to fight that atomization is for people to come out in public and be together and realize that they are a community. So anything that brought people out of their houses and into the street, even if it was just a festival, was for Benda about the rebuilding of a healthy sense of politics and a community of politics. I think in our case, we don't have a government doing this to us. We're doing it to ourselves with our smartphones, with our laptops, with our television. When I was a kid growing up in South Louisiana in the country, we were always over at somebody else's house for a crawfish boil or a barbecue or a fish fry. That doesn't happen as often today because everybody's at home watching their 57 channels on satellite TV. I think that we have to learn how to refuse that so we can say yes to community, the old-fashioned form of community, because that's the only thing that's going to build the resilience we need to carry us through the trials ahead.
People want to make a difference. They want to see that their vote is making an impact. They want to see that their money is going to something that's actually making a difference. And really what you're suggesting here in the Benedict Option is to wait out a storm in some ways, because a lot of our efforts have been to see certain people get elected, Supreme Court justices to get nominees, and these things are what people have been giving a lot of their time and energy to, and you're suggesting that in many ways those efforts I'm trying to approach this from this different perspective, this, you know, the play devil's advocate a little bit. You're suggesting to people that their efforts have been in vain in a lot of cases.
Well, I would say that they haven't been entirely in vain. I mean, look, we do have Neil Gorsuch there, and we have Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court is not everything. You know, and politics are not everything. They're not the most important thing or even close to it. Even though, you know, I came of age under Ronald Reagan, and even though we have lived through a broadly conservative era in American politics, when the Republicans, not the Democrats, dominated things, this has also run parallel with the continued breakdown of the family, with the growing secularization of American society. I think as Christians, we have to sit back and ask ourselves, what did we ultimately accomplish by putting so many of our eggs in the political basket? And what I advise for the future is that we need to take stock in the long term and understand that we are going to be an increasingly more secular society, and one that's not only not Christian, but increasingly anti-Christian. We have to understand, or have to ask ourselves, how are we going to survive as Christians? How are our children and our grandchildren going to hold on to the faith? I don't think God is going to abandon us no matter what, but we have to realize that things are not going to be nearly as easy for us in this country as it has been. In your region of the country, New England, is one of the most secular in America. And I talked to friends of mine in Massachusetts and elsewhere who are believers, and the things that they have to deal with are things that haven't reached us yet here in the deep South, but they're coming. And so in many ways, what evangelicals and Catholics and Eastern Orthodox Christians in New England do right now will be pioneering for the rest of us, things you all can do to hold on to the faith and to thrive as Christians in a post-Christian society will be a good example for the rest of us.
What is it that the church can do? It seems that removing ourselves from all of the efforts and the purpose of being involved, you know, the old moral majority of shaving, changing society, of being that loud voice, that beacon of hope, or signing the Manhattan Declaration, of all of these efforts, what can the church do if it removes itself from all of those fronts?
Right. Well, this is a good point of clarification. I don't say that we can or should completely get out of politics. I don't believe that we have that right, frankly, because if anything, or if nothing else, we have to stay involved to try to protect religious liberty. But we do need to understand that we're playing a pretty weak hand. Or to change the metaphor, a generation or two ago, we were fighting a culture war on an actual battlefield. Now the cultural left has overrun the battlefield, and that has reduced believing Christians, conservative Christians, into behaving like a guerrilla force. You know, we're having to work underground. Maybe that sounds a little dramatic to people, but if you talk to Christians in Europe who have been living through this for more than a generation, they'll give you the same answer, that you have to learn what it means to be a Christian in a society that is arrayed against you. So what I would say to American Christians is, don't panic, but look around, read the signs of the times, and understand that the only way we're going to make it through what's coming, what's in front of us now and what's coming, is to deepen our study of Scripture, deepen our knowledge of Scripture, deepen our knowledge of church history, change our practices to make to where we incorporate the rhythms of Christian life in a much more intense way in our daily lives and family prayer, things like that, and to thicken our relationship with our churches. And we can only really do this properly if we understand that we are the counterculture now. We once were the majority culture. We are definitely the counterculture. And we have to embrace that ideal and go forward from there. And go forward in hope and joy, Adam. Because, you know, a lot of people hear this and they think, oh, you must be talking about crouching at the basement, awaiting for the end. No. That's not me at all. I write about in the Benedict Option book about a particular community in Italy of very conservative Catholics who go to their normal parishes and they live in normal housing in their little seaside city, but they come together as a group for prayer, for Bible study, for community gardening, for service projects to the poor. They are robustly, joyfully Catholic. And they're not angry about it. They know exactly what they believe, and they know how countercultural they are, but they believe that this is what it takes to be faithful to what the Lord has given them. And even though I'm not a Catholic myself, I find a lot of inspiration in what they do. We can all do that.
I think, you know, one of the things that I've said this on the broadcast before, you know, our call in the Sermon on the Mount to be salt and light comes with the realization that we can't mingle, we can't dilute that salt with other gravel, otherwise we're just to be tossed aside. To have that great impact means that we have to have a concerted effort to be salt, that as we start to smell around us the rotting of dead flesh, we have to realize that this is the time, more importantly, that we become the salt that we've been called to be in the Sermon on the Mount.
Well, that's well said, and you put me in mind of a conversation I had in Norcia in Italy, where Saint Benedict was born. There's a Benedictine monastery there even today, and I've was over there a year ago talking to some of the monks, most of whom are American, and was saying to them, you know, a lot of people don't understand why you monks stay behind the walls. And, you know, we don't get to see a lot of you. People can see you when you come out to sing the Mass and maybe at a few other times, but why do you spend so much time cloistered? And the monk told me, he said, if we monks are going to be faithful to our vocation that we all believe the Lord has given us, we have got to spend that much time behind the walls in prayer and silence and scripture study. So So when we do come out to greet pilgrims and to give spiritual counsel and direction to people who come seeking it, so we'll have something to give them. He said, for you lay people, you're not called to stay behind monastery walls. You're called to be in the world. But if you don't spend a significant amount of time away from the world, so to speak, burying yourself in scripture, in prayer, in contemplation, and in building up your communal identity, you're not going to have anything to give to the world outside. You know, and from what you're saying, Adam, we do delude ourselves too much. If we kept the doors wide open to our own monasteries, our own metaphorical monasteries, we would be swamped and wouldn't be able to do the things that we need to do as Christians to deepen our walk with the Lord and deepen our Christian identity. So we do have to have a certain separation just so we can remember what it is to be called by God and what it is to be one of the followers of Jesus. And why we're different from the rest of the world. If I can say this too, I tell people that I look to Jeremiah 29 for direction as to how we Christians should live in the world today. You know, God, speaking through the prophet Jeremiah, told the Jews in their captivity in Babylon to marry and have children and establish yourselves there among Babylon. But he also expected them not to bow down to the false gods of the Babylonians. So in Daniel, when you have the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who served King Nebuchadnezzar, they were his faithful servants, but they would not bow down to the false idol, even unto death. That's what we have to be, too. We have to, even as we live in the American Babylon, if you want to say it that way, even as we live here, we have got to cultivate the inward strength as believers not to bow down to the false idols when we're put to the test. That's what the Benedict Option is about, building that kind of resilience. It gives us the same courage and the same belief in the Lord that allowed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to choose death when it came down to it, or what seemed like death, rather than betray the Lord.
Now, you've written this book as a call to the church to consider the Benedict as an option for Christians in a post-Christian culture. But this is in many cases, some will say this is something that we've seen happening over a long period of time. And they may be surprised now, but you write about this in the book. This isn't something that happened overnight. Can you talk to our listeners about some of the things that we saw that we just weren't paying attention to?
Right. Well, the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who wrote his analysis before he became a Christian, he saw the Enlightenment as in the 18th century as being one of the dramatic turning points, because that was when Western man decided and made a conscious decision to cut off its roots from the Christian past. It didn't mean people ceased to be Christian, but it meant that what they were hoping to do was to move beyond Christianity and to establish, using reason and reason alone, a common ethic. Well, that failed. But the wreckage of the failure of the Enlightenment, as we continue to live with it today, over the past century or two, we've gotten more and more secular. The Industrial Revolution came and uprooted us in many ways from our settled places, even as it made us wealthier. The Sexual Revolution was a tremendous watershed event in our history. And it went hand in hand with this revolution in individualism by which people came to believe that the choosing individual was sovereign, not God, but the choosing individual. What shocked me in doing research for this book was how this is not something that just happened in the 60s. That's kind of what I had in my mind, that this was all a 1960s thing. This stuff started happening around the turn of the 20th century. That's when it really started rolling. And so when I tell people that it's not simply a matter of refuting the 60s, even if that were possible, this radical individualism and this consumerism that is eroding the bonds of Christianity within churches and families and all over our civilization, this started really early, and it's not something that's going to be gotten rid of quickly. I think it's something we're simply going to have to live through and to hold on as best we can. I was just reading a book before we got on the radio, reading a book called Family and Civilization by a Harvard sociologist named Carl Zimmerman. Came out in the 40s, And he was going back and looking at history all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, and talking about how civilizations fall when families begin to fall apart. Zimmerman, back in 1947, a time that people like me would have thought of as a kind of a golden age of the family, he was saying right then that this is happening to us. If we don't turn it around, we're going to go the same down the same path as Rome. And well, here we are in 2017, and we didn't turn it around. I think it's not time to panic, but it is time to get real about what our prospects really are and to act in the face of what's really happening, not this dream world that we want to try to pretend is the real, are the facts, because the opposite or the alternative is too scary.
I would agree with you that these trends started much earlier than most people, most Christians would like to admit. And we should have been more conscientious and aware of them from the beginning, but now is a great opportunity for us to make those changes, which brings up another question. And I don't say this to name anyone or call anyone out, but there are quite a few people that have endorsed your book that 4 years ago were hailing a different candidate with the same policies as the one who was going to help the American people and help the Christian church. Do you see that there's a shift where many of them dropped their support of Donald Trump as a Republican candidate, mostly because of his character flaws and his behavior, as opposed to actually addressing the policies and really, 4 and 8 years previously, addressing the policies of the candidates that they endorsed in those elections?
Yeah, the whole phenomenon of Donald Trump and Christian conservatives is a really complicated one. And I'm old enough to remember the Clinton years, and I was a conservative and a Christian back then. And I was very loud. I was writing to the New York Post in those days. I was very loud in saying that we have got to stand up for moral integrity in the highest office of the land. And I believe that that's true whether the center is a Democrat or a Republican. But I also think it's true that so many Christians, and I'll fault myself on this too, we simply didn't see what was happening in our own country and how many of the Republican, standard Republican candidates that the party had been offering us every 4 years were just not responding to real changes in the country. And I didn't vote for Trump or Hillary Clinton. I didn't feel like I could morally do either thing, but I was kind of cheating because I live in Louisiana, which is definitely going to go for Trump. But I was excited when Trump got elected, not only because I thought that we had something of a reprieve on religious liberty, but also because I was hoping that this would really turn things around politically and shake things up and shake both parties up out of the dream world that they've been living in, while in the meantime, here in Louisiana where I live, you can see so much decay economically and otherwise from lack of jobs. I don't know that that's actually happened or will happen. I don't know that Donald Trump really knows what he's doing, but it's been a signal to the elites in both parties that things can't go on like they have been going for so long, and also a signal to elites in the churches. This is not just a political upheaval we're dealing with. It's also spiritual and religious and moral, and it's happening all across the West right now.
Well, it has been a great privilege to talk with you, and I've kept you on longer than I had anticipated and you had agreed to, but I want to thank you for agreeing to answer these questions and talk to us a little bit more about your book. We've been talking with Rod Dreher about his book, The Benedict Option, A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Nation. It's a really important study in this culture in which we're living, and something for all Christians to consider the foundations that we have in the church and how that church can make a difference in the world in which we live. So, Rod, again, thank you so much for being a part of our program and for sharing with us more details about your book.
Oh, it was a pleasure, and I hope all your listeners will realize all of us believers in Jesus Christ need each other now and in the future more than ever. And keep the faith and reach out to other believers, and let's form these networks now while we have time.
We hope you enjoyed this interview made possible by our ministry at Songtime Radio. You can find out more information about our ministry by visiting our website at songtime.com, where you can find this and other interviews on our podcast series, as well as our weekday broadcast, which includes teaching, interviews, and music. We also want to encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's got encouraging articles, and there is no obligation. To find out more information about our ministry, again, visit our website at songtime.com. This ministry is made possible by people just like yourself. We are 100% supported by our listeners. So if you have been blessed today, why not join with the many voices together for that one message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, with your donation to the Songtime Ministry. To make a donation, you can do so online at our website at songtime.com, as well as by mail. Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. Make a donation over the phone. It's 508-362-7070. On behalf of our entire Songtime staff and our own Dr. John DeBrine, the founder here at Songtime, who encourages you to grow in grace and not groan in disgrace, from Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller. God bless.